Hello and welcome to the Scottish Housing News podcast. I'm Kieran Finlay, the editor of Scottish Housing News, and with me, as always, is former Dundee Housing convener, Jimmy Black. Since the Tenant Protection Bill was passed into law by the Scottish Parliament in September 22, a temporary cap on in-tenancy rents and an eviction moratorium have been implemented to help support private renters during the cost of living crisis. But we're almost 18 months down the line and these measures are due to expire in a matter of weeks, leading to fears of excessive rent increases as well as a raft of eviction notices. In an effort to lay some of these concerns, the Scottish Government has proposed an adjudication scheme to ease the transition from the temporary rules until the long-awaited housing bill, with its long-term rent control measures, comes to pass.
Under the measures, which are still subject to parliamentary approval, the process for rent adjudication will temporarily be modified from April the 1st for 1 year. Any tenant who wishes to dispute a rent increase notice can apply to Rent Service Scotland or the First Tier Tribunal, which will set a fair rent based on a taper formula set out in the new regulations. But with just weeks before its implementation, and with little consultation having taken place, it seems neither tenants nor landlords are happy with this new arrangement. So today, we're asking representatives from both camps to find out if there's another way.
Later, we'll speak to Susan Actimel, who founded the UK's first social enterprise letting agency, Homes for Good. But first, we're joined by Callum Sanderson, a member of the Tenants Union Living Rent. Afternoon, Callum. Thanks for joining us. We've provided a brief description there of the transitional measures that are set to come into force from April. Is that how you understand them to be?
Yes, certainly. And I agree with you saying that these provisions are very technical and very complicated. So I think as well as them offering less protection for tenants, they're also much harder to understand for both tenants and landlords how they're going to look in practice.
Living Rent issued an open letter against the transitional measures. Can you outline what it is exactly that you're opposed to?
What we feel, for a start, the sort of 12% maximum cap is still quite excessive. The cost of living crisis hasn't really abated for anyone, and certainly not for tenants and for lower income tenants as well. It also places the onus on tenants to challenge the rent increases, which means that we could have situations where someone could, to put it colloquially, chance their luck, and put in a rent increase that's far in excess of the cap, but if the tenant is unaware or unable to navigate the system, then they might agree to that and feel like they're being priced out of their home.
I mean, isn't it logical to, if this 12% rent cap is the limit, would it not be more sensible to say that that's the kind of limit across the board and it removes that onus, like you say, from the tenant to know about challenging it?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think there's really a point to be made here about messaging from the government. And I think when we compare it to the emergency measures, we had, you know, lots of tenants saying, what does this mean? And we were able to give a very clear and concise answer that any rent increase above the 3% or latterly the 6% that it was changed to wouldn't be legal and they could challenge it. Whereas this now places the onus on tenants. The sort of the other two options as well are very difficult to get your head around. So it's just a very messy situation that I think is leaving everyone unhappy at the moment.
Callum, does Living Rent have the resources and the expertise to actually represent tenants at housing tribunals or anything similar? I mean, do you have that kind of capability?
Yeah, so I mean, it's definitely something that we do. What I would stress though is that as a tenants union, we work to empower our members to help bring on these cases themselves. So we have experienced members who run the teams, who help organise the caseloads, but ultimately what we want to do is make sure that everyone who is going through a housing action like that comes out of that with a skill set of their own to use in the future. So we certainly support tenants to fight for their rights, but we certainly don't just turn up and sort of represent someone as like a solicitor would.
And what about direct action? Is there an opportunity to oppose landlords by actually gathering outside their offices or outside their flat, the flats they rent?
Yeah, certainly. I think that's been very successful for Living Rent in the past, and I think we make no secret of that. ultimately, it's preferable to have mechanisms in place that prevents that or neutralises the need for that. But unfortunately, a lot of the time when the cards are down, it's really the only option we have left. And what I would say is, while it is the last option, it is often a very, very effective option that we're not afraid to use.
Housing tribunals exist already, like for evictions, for instance. Mm-hmm. Have you personally or your fellow members had any experience of these tribunals? Are you confident in them as a process?
So the housing tribunal, I think, is an improvement on the old system, but still leaves a lot to be desired. We've got some fantastic results at tribunals, but when you look at tribunal statistics, what we find is that landlords disproportionately have very effective legal representation. Tenants oftentimes have none or very little support. And what we see in the statistics for outcomes is that landlords that have more at their disposal, that means that they can have representation, oftentimes find that they end up with better results. And that's something that has to be equalised. And I think particularly, you know, the previous rent review system was pretty inadequate and again, very difficult to use. So I think consideration has to be given to that as well, if the view is that it's going to be more commonly used in the months to come.
April the 1st brings with it an end to the moratorium on evictions. And that's another thing altogether. I mean, given that tenants have probably been struggling to meet their rents in some cases, landlords are going to take the opportunity to put them out. Do you have any concerns about a sharp increase in evictions?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, to quote Patrick Harvey's words back at him, I think opening the market to open market conditions will lead to a cliff edge. I think there's no two ways about that. Being told that your rent's going to increase at a level that you can't afford is the same as being evicted. So we're going to see both of these cases happening more and more. And I think it's obviously a responsibility for us as a union to make sure that we're as prepared and as able to deal with those as possible. But at the same time, the government has to recognise that that is not sustainable. There's an estimated one-third rise in homelessness going to occur over the next couple of years. And we have to do everything we can to avoid that.
If landlords are getting to the point where actually they're losing money by letting their flats out, then they're going to have to get rid of their tenants, aren't they? So, you know, is there a structural problem here in the market that you can comment on?
I think there's a wider point there about sort of housing as an investment asset. And I think what we're seeing in a lot of cases, particularly with changes in interest rates, is that buy-to-let landlords who have over-leveraged themselves are very quickly seeing that their investment's becoming less and less feasible. What I would say is that every investment carries that risk. There is, I think, a larger portion in the market of landlords who own their property outright, which we find are less problematic to deal with in some respects. So it's something that people who are looking to housing as an investment really have to consider, whether or not they really have the means to be able to carry this out in the event of the sort of downturn that we're facing at the moment.
The vast majority of landlords are individuals with a small number of properties, sometimes only one. If we drive them out of the market, then where do people live?
Yeah, so I think this is a quite a complicated issue, but what I would say is that the sort of landlord exodus that we're talking about, I think, and from our understanding of the figures that we've seen, is yet to materialise. I think the number of rental properties that are on the market just now have actually increased, particularly September 2022, when the emergency measures were put into place. And I think that's the result of what has been quite comprehensive action in relation to things like short-term lets. But to go back to your point about sort of supply, I think, well, if landlords sell up and houses enter the open market, they'll either be bought to be lived in, they'll usually be picked up by another landlord who will take that on. So the main concern is the security of tenants and tenancy when landlords have to give up the property. But that's, again, something that the government's going to have to look at over the next few months.
Well, another supply-related question. People who want to build mid-market rent type properties, whether it's mid-market or market rent, they're discouraged by some of the rent controls that have been put in place and the inability to evict tenants. Is it a concern to living rent that we're possibly discouraging some of the big professional landlords who want to do this as a proper business, not just as a retirement nest egg? We're kind of keeping them out of the market by the rent controls that the government have been imposing.
Well, you know, I would say there's lots of areas for investment that are quite heavily regulated that certainly doesn't discourage investors, but I understand that the sort of substantial change in the housing scape may have that effect. However, what I would say and what we really take issue with is the sort of build-to-rent model as a solution to the housing crisis in its entirety. I think there's a really serious issue here. Not one of our concerns isn't just about the amount of available housing, but the price. And what I have then, if people build and lease these properties at market rent, it makes it less and less likely and less feasible to look at solutions that will actually bring housing costs down to a manageable level. And I think there's a concern that if you do that, you undertake this sort of mass private development, particularly in the private rented sector, that you're going to entrench the market at its current level. But we certainly, I think the question that we can't avoid is that we need more social housing, I think, to try and loosen off the pressure in the private rented sector, because it is fundamentally now playing a role that it did not play, you know, 30 or 40 years ago in terms of the demographics and the size of the sector.
These measures proposed by Patrick Harvey do seem to have been fast-tracked somewhat. I don't know if Living Rent took part in any consultation, but what would you like to see put in place for the next 12 months?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, the ideal situation was that the protections that were already in place remained as they were. Like I said at the top of the show, the cost of living crisis has not abated for the vast majority of people. So I think this jump from a 6% cap to a 12% cap is extremely worrying. If that's not something that can be done at the moment, then I think at the very least making this more easily navigated and more clearly understood. I think the work has to be done by the government to sort of propagate these measures and to actually inform people on how they operate and how they work. Living Rent was not enormously involved in the consultation for this, which is something that we certainly took issue with. But we can certainly the government at every stage and get as much support as possible.
Looking ahead, the government does intend to bring forward the housing bill. Patrick Harvey said this will contain long-term rent control measures. Mm-hmm. What exactly would you like to see introduced?
I think there's, you know, I could talk all day, but I think one of the really fundamental things that we really, really need in Redfield is that it has to be tied to the property and not the tenancy. I mean, we've seen ourselves, I mean, there was, what, a 16% increase in Edinburgh over the last year, and that's with these really strong protections in tenancy. So it shows that taking that approach that we've taken, you know, for years, any rent protection has always been focused on tenancy. We have to think broader. We have to have these controls in place per property. That means that, you know, housing prices can't soar up every time a tenancy comes in.
In terms of joint tenancies, that's been a problem where one person wants to leave and the other person wants to stay, or alternatively where one person isn't paying the rent and the other person is. And you're trying to bring that kind of tenancy to an end. Is there any structural reforms that you can think of which would enable joint tenants to get a better deal, to have a bit more certainty about where they stand?
Again, I think it comes back to having rent controls tied to the property, because the fundamental issue is with these situations that when one person terminates, it's not that they drop off the lease. It's not the same lease anymore. It's effectively a new tenancy, which means all the protections that stop increases become a real issue. And I think we've addressed some issues in joint tenancies, like the Deposit Scotland scheme has been very, very helpful. But again, we need a situation whereby notice can be given and the lease can be transferred to the remaining tenant without that involving basically signing a new lease and basically sort of meaning that all those protections effectively evaporate when that other person leaves the tenancy.
Can I ask you a quick question in the social rented sector? When the eviction moratorium ends, there's unquestionably going to be evictions in the social rented sector. Mm-hmm. I mean, some tenants just simply haven't paid any rent at all, a very small number, and others have built up some serious arrears. Does Living Rent accept that sometimes it is actually justified to remove a tenant?
I mean, the grounds for eviction are there for a reason. It's not really my place to comment on it. What I would say is that in the social housing sector, they are better equipped to deal with things like rent arrears. They're more easily managed, but it wouldn't really be my place to say whether or not that's justified. It's very much a case-by-case basis, as I've certainly seen in my experience as a member of the union.
Callum, thank you very much. Thanks for representing Living Rent today on the podcast. We're moving on now to talk to Susan Actemel from Homes for Good, a social enterprise which lets property and attempts to do that in a way that's good for everyone. Thanks, Colin.
We're joined now by Susan Actonel, who in 2013 founded Homes for Good, the UK's first social enterprise letting agency. Susan, what does that mean in practice?
So Homes for Good is a social enterprise. We operate in the way that any good letting agent should, but the difference is that we are a company that reinvests its profits directly into our social aims. And our social aims are to improve standards in the private rented sector, both in terms of quality of property and management standards. We're also committed to enabling access to quality homes for people on the lowest incomes. And one of our other central aims is to lead by example in the private rented sector, both in terms of how we behave as landlords ourselves, but also in replicating the Homes for Good model so that there's a more standardised ethical approach to working within the private rented sector across the UK.
And how many properties are you responsible for?
We currently manage just over 580 properties, and within those 580 properties, we own directly 340 of those that we've bought ourselves through investment that we've raised since 2014. I'm also a private landlord. That was how Homes for Good came about, because I was dissatisfied with what I saw in the letting agency industry. So I've been a private landlord myself for over 25 years.
Okay, Patrick Harvey, the Tenants' Rights Minister, was in touch with some landlord bodies about what happens when the government transitions from the temporary rent cap legislation. Did he speak to yourself?
No.
No. What would you have told him?
I think I would have probably told him what I told him way before the rent cap was in place, is that actually the fundamental issue we have in the country is supply, full stop. It's supply at all ends of the spectrum. And when the demand and supply situation is in balance, the market regulates itself. And that is an unpopular view, but it's true. And what we can see from what's happened in the market on the ground is that the rent freeze legislation or the rent cap legislation, and then the additional eviction moratorium legislation has not had the desired effect for tenants. It may have been well intentioned, but it's been ill conceived, and the execution of it has been detrimental to tenants looking to move, and has also created a massive amount of uncertainty for tenants who are in their own tenancies, because it's becoming increasingly apparent that many landlords cannot sustain being landlords anymore because of the competing pressures of the direction of travel of Scottish Government with legislation and the rapidly increasing costs around interest rates, changed taxation and other operating costs. Yeah. So we've ended up in a really disproportionate situation. And so I think if I had been consulted about extending this in some way, and the way that it's been extended is even more complicated and convoluted than it needs to be and than it was before, I would have said leave it and let's see what happens in the market.
It is a tricky predicament the government finds itself in on this. On one hand, landlords have been restricted from recouping increasing costs, as you said, but renters, private renters, often the poorest in society, have felt the brunt of the cost of living crisis, and you're saying that these proposed measures don't really help either.
Well, I think in your press release, Patrick Harvey talked about introducing this measure to tackle the cost of living crisis. Now, if we all look at pre-September 2022, where were the main increases in our costs for all of us? It was on energy bills and on food, and then on other, you know, day-to-day, and on fuel. They were the three key areas. There was no history of the landlords in the private rented sector putting up their rents every year. So we legislated against something that wasn't actually happening at scale. It would have been happening with a small minority, but all of the academic research in the professional industry, research that's come through, shows that in deference to what's happening in the social sector, the private rented sector is not accustomed to raising its rents annually every year. So he was addressing an issue that didn't actually exist really to start with in any material way.
Susan, might seem a daft question, but why don't the private landlords put their rents up every year? Social landlords do, and they say that they have to because that's the way that they can keep up with inflation and, you know, continue delivering the good service. So why would private landlords allow their rents to lapse for a year or two before they put them up?
I suppose that is down to a couple of things. It's down to the differences between the way the social sector operates and manages its housing and the standards that are the norm, not legislative standards, but the standards that are perhaps the norm, and the way that the private market operates. So, and actually there's an element of business savvy and business sense around this. So most landlords will tell you that if they have a good tenant paying their rent regularly, why would they jeopardise that for the sake of £20 or £30 a month? Because the private rented sector is much more transient, it's much more fluid, and while tenant groups can rightly argue that it is home for people and tenants need security, nobody disagrees with that. Equally, tenants have got much more flexibility of choice as well, and we all know that the private rented sector is a flexible option for many people. So if a landlord put their rent up by £20 a month and that was enough to disgruntle the tenant, or for the tenant to think, you know, I'm going to try and find somewhere else to live, that the landlord then has to start again, probably has quite a lot of cost associated with bringing the property up to scratch, because as you'll be aware, in the private rented sector there are standards expected around decoration and flooring and different things like that. So it doesn't make business sense, if you've got a good tenant, to risk losing them for the sake of £20 a month when it might cost you £2,000 or £3,000 of void costs in the advertising. Why would you disrupt the apple cart? That has been the majority of good landlords have thought in that way, Homes for Good and me included, over a number of years. So that's just different. And we now feel, I've heard a number of landlords say, had we put our rents up 3% a year every year, we wouldn't be in this situation now. But actually, our tenants would have had a 30% increase over 10 years. So there's always a nuance around looking at the headline statements that come from the social and private sector, but actually looking at the detail of what it means in practice.
OK, let's talk about the practicality of the new system. The market values around the country seem to vary enormously. If you look at the City Let's figures, you know, there can be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds difference between, let's say, Aberdeen and South Lanarkshire in terms of rent levels. It's astonishing, just the cost of property in different parts of the country. How does the system that is being proposed cope with that? How do landlords work out what a reasonable market rent is when, you know, at the beginning of this process?
Well, I think the first thing is that there is, you know, the market rent is whatever it is on the day. And I think it's quite obvious. This is why, you know, I feel that the market will regulate itself. If you look at places like North Ayrshire, the market rent is flat as a pancake. You know, 15 years ago when I started, first owned a property in North Ayrshire, the rent was £350 a month for a one-bed flat. And the market rent 15 years later is barely £400 a month. Why is that? It's because the demand is lower and there's actually much greater supply of social housing in those areas and local authority housing. Therefore, there's not as much demand for private property. But then if you look at somewhere like Glasgow, the rent has probably increased by 25% in the last 15 months. Incidentally, since the rent measures were put in place. So the rent measures have actually caused increases in the market. So the only place that landlords can look to set their rents or letting agents is Rightmove, CityLets, and what's already on the market. So that's the sort of benchmark, really. And it rises and falls. So when I started in Homes for Good in 2013, there was an oversupply of two-bedroom properties in Denniston, for example. And there were hardly any one-bedroom properties. So you do your market analysis and say, well, there's 15 two-bed properties on the market at a certain amount of rent. We're going to have to go a wee bit lower if we want to let our property. That's the way that rents adjust themselves. It's supply and demand.
And in terms of the what's coming, the housing bill and so on, do you think landlords are quite likely to just say, well, they're offering us 12%, let's all go for 12%, let's just get the maximum increase we can because we don't know what's coming around the corner in terms of rent controls, so let's get what we can now?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I was at a landlord event a couple of weeks ago where this the proposed way that this would operate was spelled out very clearly by somebody, and the reaction in the room was, oh my God, how complicated is that? I can't actually understand what that means. And I think the important thing for me, actually the difference between 6% and 12% is not a huge amount. Really, in real terms, if you think about it, what worries me about this legislation is what it is going to mean in practice for a number of things. Letting agents are going to become paralysed by having to go through these tribunal processes. So it's diverting us. This is creating more busy work that doesn't need to be there. Living Rent are quite right about, you know, the tenants are then in the uncomfortable position that if a landlord chooses to put their rent up by whatever they think is appropriate, the tenant, the onus is on the tenant to challenge that. That's really uncomfortable, and it's another example of legislation creating an adversarial relationship between tenants and landlords, and that is the last thing that we all want. I also think the first year tribunal wouldn't be a happy place to work at the moment, given the number of cases. You know, it's just creating a whole pile of regulatory work and processing and admin and backlog that is going to be really difficult to implement in practice. So we haven't decided on our rent policy yet. We'll be deciding that at board level, and we maybe behave slightly differently, that we have a very acute eye on the welfare of our tenants and their affordability. But my instinct would be not to go anywhere near adjudication if possible. Mm-hmm. And if that means putting a lower rent increase in to just keep going without any hassle for the tenant or the landlord, that would be my instinct about what to do. Now, I'm saying that in the context of our operating costs, and I want to come back to something that has been brought up around landlords losing money. Landlords are hemorrhaging money just now for two reasons. One is interest rates, and anyone on a variable interest rate will have their cost of capital, their cost of their mortgage, increased by at least 140%. 140%, 3% or 6%, 12% income is not going to get anywhere close to that. There are also extreme tax measures that are now being put in place by Westminster that have now, the full force of them is unravelled. Many landlords are operating at a loss every month, a cash loss. So there's a whole sense that this is becoming harder and harder to operate within the private rented sector, I think. And that can only damage the security of homes for people who need them.
Well, let's talk about supply a little bit. The landlords who are driven out of the market because they're losing money, will their properties just be picked up by other richer landlords who will be able to afford to take them on?
I think the language you use is interesting, richer landlords. I'm not sure I know many really, really rich landlords. I think there's a wee bit of an urban myth there about landlords. But what I do see, I've been watching, tracking closely where properties go. We're also selling some properties. I'm selling properties that are no longer viable. So, and I'm one of the, I am not a landlord that's in it to make profit. So where are the properties going? There are probably three or four destinations. One, quite a lot of the properties that Homes for Good has sold, and we've just sold properties as part of our asset management. You know, we're not in a distressed need to do it or anything, but we just are refreshing the portfolio when there's an opportunity. Most of our properties have gone to first time buyers. Now, the argument there will be, aha, they might have been renters before. So that's a good thing. That's a good thing. If we're able to have people moving into home ownership that they can afford, that's a good thing. Some properties are going to investors, but what's quite interesting is the investors who are coming in now, and this is not about build to rent, that's a whole other area that I'm becoming more involved in. But if you look at the new generation of investors that are coming in to buy properties, I wouldn't call them rich landlords, but they are investors. They are focused very, very much so on financial return and yield in a way that the older generation of maybe accidental landlords were not quite as laser focused on that. So what we're doing is the old landlords are feeling pushed out and the new landlords are not actually going to be any more focused on or any less focused on the finances. The third area that we've seen, although I'm sure this is tapering back now, is properties getting bought to be used for serviced accommodation or Airbnb. But I think, you know, the short-term licensing has done a good job in making that a much more robust process to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. So that's really where these properties are going. But the thing that happens when there's a supply issue, as you mentioned earlier, it's the people almost at the bottom of the market who suffer. So the first-time buyer who can afford to have a deposit takes that property out of the private rented sector, and that's one less property available to anybody else who can't afford to buy.
Just to pick up some points raised by Callum Sanderson from Living Rent earlier, one of which was to tie any rent increase or lease to the property and not the tenant, not the tenancy, shall I say. Is that something that you would be on board with? Could it work?
Devil's in the detail is the answer to that. The devil's in the detail for all of these things. It depends on what the starting point of the rent was. It's something I've not looked at it closely. I'm sure that the academics and the Scottish Government will be examining all sorts of rent control from around the world. I think maybe something similar to that's happening in Germany and in Berlin. It would depend on what the starting point of the rent level was. The problem that we've got with current rent legislation and the sort of the pattern of lawmaking that seems to be going on at the minute is that it's knee-jerk and it's like a line in the sand on the day. So if you have a tenant, and if you have a property where the rent may be artificially low, so for example, we have a tenant who has just moved out actually because they've moved in with their partner, and we bought the property when they were in situ as a tenant. The rent was £280 a month. Now the market rent is probably £600 a month for that property, and our intention is now to renovate that property and upgrade it, and we'll probably let it out at the housing benefit rate, which is probably about £400-425. But my point there is, if you had done on the day, whatever the rent is in that property is the starting point. That doesn't work and it's not fair. So it's really all about the detail of how that's applied. And if it's applied fairly on a sort of market analysis, then I wouldn't be averse to it. I'm not saying I support it because I don't know enough about the detail, but I can see why that would feel fairer.
Would it help to clear up the difficulties with joint tenants when one leaves and the other one wants to stay, and landlords have been taking the opportunity to hike the rents in that situation?
So I don't see how it would. I don't see how those two things are connected unless I'm missing something, because if the rent for a property is £600, whether one person or 10 people live in that property, the rent for the property is £600. I think what I'll also say, though, is one of the problems we have is the sensationalising in the private rented sector that's going on at the minute, with anecdotes becoming the headline. And I'm quite interested to know exactly how many landlords have taken the opportunity to hike rents when a joint tenancy has come to an end, because it's been all over the press, it's been in the BBC, and I have not seen many direct examples of that in practice. So I don't believe that's the norm. I don't think that's what normally happens. I think that it's obviously a loophole that could happen. But to then make that a reason for changing legislation across the country when it's probably happening in a minority of cases is really quite worrying.
In terms of build to rent, you mentioned that you were getting interest in build to rent. And build to rent has been affected by the Scottish Government's legislation in that big players have said that it's put them off, basically, because the uncertainty of the rents they'll be able to charge in the future means that they can't, their business plans can't necessarily add up, they can't be sure. So they're looking for certainty. Are you managing to find a way into that market which enables you to have a viable business?
So we're not actively involved in build to rent at the minute. We're starting to talk to some build to rent developers about how we can support the management of properties and potentially work with them around some affordable offering within their developments. But I've been involved in these discussions with the build to rent sector. I've been invited into the networks around this. And what is absolutely clear is a couple of things have come out of it, but the main thing is a rent cap of 3% or 5% or whatever a rent cap might be, that's not the main issue. And one build to rent developer, when the 3% cap was introduced, said we were only at 4% anyway in our business plan. So that's not a material issue. The material issue is uncertain. There are two material issues. One is uncertainty of legislation. It's the approach to lawmaking. So the fact that a legislation can get introduced overnight with no real consultation, effective immediately, means that you, and it's happened now two or three times, means that you, it's the environment that that creates. It's the sense of uncertainty. It's not about the absolute amounts of money, because you run that in a business model and it either works or it doesn't work. But it's what you don't know is going to happen in the future. And after two or three instances of us seeing that in practice, you then start to feel unsure about it. I think the other thing, probably less so for build-to-rent developers, but definitely for individual landlords, is that there is a hostile environment. It feels like a hostile environment for landlords, and nobody wants to be unpopular. Nobody wants to feel like they're doing, that they've got some sort of business that is shady or is not welcomed. So there's just, it doesn't feel like a welcoming environment for investment in Scotland at the moment.
I'll just finish off by returning to these transitional measures. I quite agree with you about Rent Service Scotland and the first tier tribunal about to be absolutely inundated with cases requiring hundreds if not thousands of staff. I don't know if you're going to know the answer to this, Susan, but you know, this backlog seems inevitable. What would happen in a case where the adjudication hasn't, you know, it's at the bottom of a pile, but the weeks and months are going by? What is the rent? Is it the one agreed by the landlord? Or does the tenant pay what they continue to pay from the start, you know, while this adjudication rent has been set?
Well, I think that's for the government to decide. I mean, I've got no idea. I've not even thought about that. But you're right. You know, what is it that happens? But that just points to uncertainty and limbo and a sense of fear. You know, the stress that this causes for individual tenants and landlords by putting them up against each other in this way is really horrible. So. And if the tenant doesn't pay the increase, what does that mean? Does that mean that they then have got a backlog of arrears to pay in a year's time? The government has to think all of these things through. And I suppose my question is, okay, if this is what's going to happen next, how much additional resource is going into the tribunal system? It is already breaking at the seams. And we can see, even with arrears cases that are legitimate, the arrears are excessive because of the length of time that it takes to even get through the backlog, you know, with when landlords are going through a process. So there is already a backlog, and the first-tier tribunal is already under pressure. So what are the additional resources that are going to get put through? We've got, about 300,000 tenancies in the private rented sector. So what would happen if every one of them went to adjudication?
Yeah,
that's the government.
Absolutely, absolutely is. It's something that's been on my mind since I've read about this, and I don't know the answer. Another question, last one from me, is something I spoke to Callum about as well, is again, with these measures, a 12% increase has been said to be the limit. Would it not be more wise to set that as a limit across the board?
I think the fear about that would be, and this is possible behaviour, but it's, you know, within a horrible situation where landlords are behaving, the market is responding to legislation and then being vilified for the response. That's what's happening at the moment. So if that were the case, then there's a fair chance that 12% would become the norm, and that's high. So I'm not sure I agree with that.
Okay.
I think that it either has to be nothing, or it has to be probably a lower figure is the maximum. But this overcomplicating it, to me, what this feels like is the government realising that there are all these different unintended consequences coming out of the wash, and they're trying to say, we are helping, you know, we've created this taper to get a fair balance between what landlords might need and what tenants might need, and actually everybody is getting into a mess with it. So I wouldn't support a blanket increase of 12% because that feels high. But I think what's interesting is if you look at the social housing sector, there are housing associations that are, I've seen a number of housing associations that are increasing their rent by 10%. And nobody's questioning that. And it's quite interesting. And, you know, it won't be long before housing association rents are getting close to private rented sector rents anyway. So if you were wanting to put me on the spot, I'm not going to come up with a figure because I haven't thought about it, but I would say, yeah, a simple maximum, probably lower than 12%, though. On existing tenancies, on new tenancies, they should be left to the market.
That's great. Thanks, Susan. That brings us to the end of this episode, a bit of a landmark one for Scottish Housing News, as it's episode 50 of the podcast. My special thanks go to all our guests over the past 2 and a bit years for giving up their time to share their expertise. My personal thanks to Jimmy Black for steering the ship with his presenting and editing skills that make the podcast what it is. And not least of all to all the listeners, without whom it wouldn't be worth doing. We don't plug this half as much as we should, but you can help us grow the podcast by leaving a quick 5-star review on whichever platform you're using to listen to this episode. You can like and share it on social media and tell your colleagues, but most importantly, just continue to do what you're doing and listening to the show. Final thing, there are changes and improvements in the pipeline over the next few weeks, but we love hearing your feedback on what you've heard and what you'd like to hear in the future. If you've got topics you'd like us to discuss, or people you'd like us to talk to, please let us know. You can email us at newsdesk@scottishnews.com or get in touch with Jimmy or I on LinkedIn. My thanks for this episode go to Susan Actimel from Homes for Good, Callum Sanderson from Living Rent. Jimmy and I will be back with episode 51 in a couple of weeks.